Hello and welcome to Hurt Less, Live More with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and Dr. Mark Goulston. Lovely to see you again, Mark, and lovely to have with us today, Nikki Butler. Now, Nikki Butler is the autistic joyologist, and Nikki, I am so looking forward to finding out what that is and also how you came to it. So welcome, Nikki.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. So tell us what the autistic joyologist is and does and how you got there.
So the autistic joyologist is really aimed at empowering and inspiring other autistic and ADHD female entrepreneurs to embrace their neurodiverse brains and to really play to their strengths and to create thriving and fulfilling lives on their terms and to define their own version of success rather than trying to fit in with the societal expectations. But actually the driving force behind it was I have this really deep passion about ensuring our future generations don't repeat a lot of these experiences that many of us that have had with late diagnosis through lack of real understanding and acceptance of the fact that being neurodiverse means that we're different, not less. And I'm naturally a really introverted person, but I felt like I couldn't not step out as the autistic joyologist. So that name kind of came to me because I want to help others live their joy on their own terms, but ultimately be a catalyst for change for future generations.
Well, I think that sounds fantastic. You have been diagnosed yourself. So how did that come about? And you know, what did that mean to you in your life? I think you had a late diagnosis, didn't you?
Yeah, my mid-40s. And actually, the ADHD diagnosis came first. And I hadn't really thought about it. It was a friend of mine had half said it as a joke. And then the following week, a business mentor that I was talking to had raised it on a more serious level. And I just thought I was going to research it because, you know, it's a bit of a coincidence. And as I started to read about it, everything started to make sense to me. I was thinking, wow, this things that I'd lived my life, basically feeling like I was rubbish at adulting. That's what I would have said to you at any point. I'm rubbish at adulting. And I felt, how does everybody else seem to be able to do these seemingly easy, you know, living tasks that I just can't do? And it actually took me 2 months of researching, reading books before I approached my doctor. My doctor's response said, well, yes, a few people have realized they're a little bit weird, I'll refer you. Not the response I wanted from my doctor.
I wouldn't have wanted that response either.
No. But as I was waiting for diagnosis, I carried on doing lots of research and actually just that learning and understanding was helpful. But it was during my assessment for ADHD that the psychiatrist said to me, I'm referring you for a full autism assessment. And again, that had never crossed my mind. And then I went through full assessment and was diagnosed autistic. And it was, I'd say it was life-changing because it really helped me make sense of everything I'd experienced before. But it also brought with it a lot of turmoil and grief because as I'm piecing together my life and realizing why I am the way I am, I had to deal with the fact that I had shamed myself most of my life. I had become a bit of a chameleon and been a version of myself that anybody else wanted. I'd led a very isolated life, so never been married, never had children, because I was hiding all of these things about myself. I just thought I was broken. So I was on the one hand really being able to understand myself, I had to grieve the life that I potentially could have had I have known sooner. But I tried to look at it from a point of view of this is who I am and I need to deeply understand myself now. I was quite excited to think, well, who am I under all these layers that I've lived behind for years? And I just decided to come at it from, you know, being really curious from a place of being lovingly curious about who I was as a neurodiverse woman.
Wow. Mark, as the psychiatrist here, what do you think of that?
Well, Nikki, say more about going from shame to self-acceptance.
Yeah, that wasn't a quick journey. And actually, it's no coincidence that I have a decade worth of personal development work that I've done. And predominantly that has been reading Brené Brown's work, who is a very well-known shame researcher. And that irony was not lost on me when I started to think about, I had this deep shame and embarrassment of who I was, constantly feeling rejected and unloved for every part of me that I would, you know, the real part of me that would slip through would at some point be crushed by somebody else. So I learned to hide a lot of it. And what was really interesting in that kind of journey of self-discovery was I was learning about the parts of myself I really liked. That's where I started. I thought, right, I'm a successful businesswoman at the point of diagnosis, running a multi-award winning skin and scar clinic. I'm like, I'm successful on many levels. Let's start by looking at what those strengths are. And then as I started to unravel some of the strengths, what became really interesting was some of the strengths that I could now see were things that other people had told me were my failings or my weaknesses. And that really ignited something in me to think, hang on, I've been listening to this narrative of what others perceive to be my failings and my flaws. But in this context, they're my strengths, my creativity, my ability to think about things differently, this immense compassion that I have for other people, because I have fought to be accepted and to belong for so many years, means that I can extend so much compassion and understanding to other people. And so I think as I started to put those pieces together and I guess tell myself a different story and let go of some of the shame and have self-compassion, I think that self-compassion and self-acceptance was huge for me, because many of the things that I spent my entire life beating myself up about kind of fell away as I started to look at it through fresh eyes. That's not to say that's been like a completely upward trajectory. I still catch myself with moments of shame now or reflection, but I can reframe it.
You know, I want to share something and see what you think of it. I write a lot. You know, it goes into my head and I write it. And years ago, I wrote about pseudo ADD.
Okay.
And what I said is, I made a distinction between primary ADD, in which you're interrupted by your brain, and secondary ADD is when you're interrupted by the world and you can't say no to it.
Right.
And I think I have secondary ADD because I'll drop whatever I'm doing, you know, when someone has something that is more urgent for them. And of course, it's more urgent because it's about them. And there's a part of me that wish that I was a little less emo. So I'm a bit too empathic. And so, I mean, JJ, and I'll say, well, you know, I could have been more accomplished, although JJ will say, Mark, stop it already. Exactly. What you've accomplished is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And yet it's in many different directions. And so, as a result, my life has been very interesting because it's in many different directions. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little bit more than a dilettante, but I can be a dilettante. Whereas the people I know who are probably neurodiverse, they can stay so focused and on task and not get distracted by interpersonal stuff. And so I just want to share that because I think I'm trying to do a better job of being able to just say no to people who, you know, want my attention fully right here and now. Drop whatever you're thinking. And, you know, and I love my wife of 45 years. And, but it's, if she'll come in, because something, you know, just came into her mind, she has to tell me, I immediately drop whatever I'm thinking, you know, because if I don't, you know, she could be hurt or huffy or whatever. And so, but I'm trying to do a better job of, you know, being less emotionally distracted by everyone else's needs.
And I think that's challenging, isn't it? That's, you know, as I was listening to you speak, that's something that I swing between being really kind of hyper focused and engaged with what I'm doing. And it's interesting. So I'm writing a book, and I've actually just been writing today about boundaries, people pleasing, and the power of hyper focus. But that, you know, it's very interchangeable and actually for me not controllable in many respects. So there are definitely periods where I can become really hyper focused, engaged in what I'm doing, and actually I've now learned to embrace that. So the way that I work within my business, I've stopped trying to make my brain neurotypical, and I will embrace the hyper focus. But other times, if I'm interrupted in a task, somebody asks me a question and there's a distraction, it can be all consuming and all absorbing. And then I can't get back. There's nothing getting me back to what I was doing. And then that can be my whole day gone. But walking into a room, so other people's energy levels and their needs, I think both from being autistic and ADHD, there's this misconception that there's no level of empathy or no compassion or understanding of other people's emotions. I have to be very careful of that, because I can walk into a room and pick up on other people's energy, and not just one person's, other people's energy like a sponge. And it can, I wear ear loops when I go out, which help me sort of with the noise and with everything that's going on. But the emotional energy within a room can feel really, really overpowering. And I'm a prolific people pleaser. I've really had to work on that. You know, somebody else's needs would always come above mine. You know, I would take on more. I didn't want to say no. I didn't want to let people down. And I think that it can be very difficult to learn what those personal healthy boundaries look like, and then how to manage and communicate them when you are naturally somebody that will absorb other people's needs and emotions and want to fulfill those needs. I still don't have that balance exactly right.
I'm not sure that anybody does, do they? And I recognized myself in so much of what you were saying there. Sorry, Mark, I interrupted you. You were going to say something.
Yeah, I come up with article ideas. So here's an article idea if you like it. Just say no for respect.
Yeah. That's really powerful, isn't it? Because, mm-hmm. you know, I think for me, I remember speaking to a coach shortly after I was diagnosed, and she said, what healthy boundaries do you have in place? And I remember saying, what?
Yeah.
A boundary? She's like, what are those? The boundaries? Yeah. I was like, I don't have any, because my boundaries were whatever anybody else wanted or needed from me. That was what I did. I met those expectations. And actually, that was through fear of rejection and judgment. That was through fear of not being good enough, not, you know, being able to cope and others judging that. And now I say that, you know, healthy boundaries are essential because they are a form of self-respect, and they are setting the tone for how you allow others to treat you. You know, you need to be able to communicate your limits for your own well-being, because there's only so much any of us can take. And it is absolutely starts for me with self-respect, but you then have to be respectful of other people's boundaries in that dynamic as well.
Yeah, completely agree. And I want to talk more about that. But first of all, we've got to take a short break. We'll be right back after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the practical alchemist, Dr. Mark Goulston, and our fabulous guest today, Nikki Butler, the autistic joyologist. And Nikki, you know, before the break when you were talking, I kept hearing myself in so much of what you were talking about, you know, from the boundaries thing. Yes, I mean, it took me years to understand boundaries, the energy side of things. Yes, absolutely. Working out how to deal with that took me a long time. And then, of course, I was working with somebody a while back, some years back now, and I think we were talking about the autistic spectrum. And she just suddenly turned around to me and said, well, I think you're probably on the spectrum. And I'm like, what? But of course, probably I am. But, you know, not in any way that anybody would necessarily recognize as being autistic. And of course, the autistic spectrum is so vast, it's so wide. But it's interesting, isn't it, that if you look sort of neurotypical and you get on with life and you're successful as you are as a businesswoman, people just don't even consider it.
And I think that, you know, that's such a big driver for stepping out as the autistic joyologist. And when I was diagnosed, you know, I was excited to share my diagnosis because all of a sudden my world made sense. And I shared it with people that were in my close circle. And I was met with not what I was expecting. I was expecting support, kindness, curiosity. But I was met with, you don't look autistic, you don't seem like you've got ADHD, and things like, well, if you have even got it. And that actually was so hurtful. And I felt like I'd spent decades trying to be a version of myself to fit in and not belonging. And then there I was suddenly saying, well, here's the real me. This is who I am. And I'm going, no, you don't look autistic enough to us. And so then I was in this, I felt so isolated. And when I was doing a lot of research, you know, the fact is that the autistic spectrum is built around small boys. And it's only been in recent years that research has been done and there's been an understanding that it presents differently in females. There's still a very long way to go with that. But, you know, I was not immune to those outdated stereotypes. That is how I got to my mid-40s, not having a clue I was ADHD or autistic. And I think that is what is so important, is that we need to understand that the spectrum is vast. And my belief is it's not just about having core autistic or ADHD traits. I believe that we have our traits, but so many things impact them, from, you know, our entire sort of childhood, our socioeconomic background, our experiences, our trauma, our families, the things that we've been exposed to. They're like, to name just a few, it's so vast because that defines how we respond in the situations and how we cope and the strategies we have in place and how much we camouflage, you know. I love my family dearly, but we were not a family that spoke about emotions. So I was highly sensitive. Like anybody would have told you when I was younger, I cried a lot. I was anxious a lot. I was very emotional and prone to overreacting. I think many would tell you. But because we didn't speak about emotions, it was something I learned to bury really deep inside. And I think what's really important now is, so Brené Brown puts this so beautifully. I watched a clip that she did on YouTube, and the premise, that the kind of message was, I will not negotiate who I am with you. And that really struck home with me, because I think what we really need to be doing now, in my opinion, for those of us that have late diagnosis in particular, is coming out and talking about our experiences. And for society to start to listen to our true lived experiences, and to start to understand and accept every single individual as that being their truth, that is their lived truth, whether it fits a stereotype that somebody has in their head of what autism or ADHD look like. As a society, we need to release that and start believing and listening to lived experiences. And coming at that from a place of compassion, kindness, curiosity, because that's how we're going to break down these stereotypes. That's how we're going to break down the boundaries. And, you know, as in these boundaries that are restrictive and isolating, because I, for one, want our future generations to be unapologetic and authentic and feel that neurodiverse. So for me, the word neurodiverse is magic. It's like the diversity is key to success in this world. It would be boring if we were all the same. And diversity for me means different, not less. And that's magic, and it's powerful, and it's extraordinary. And that is something that is so important to me, to get that message out there, to try and create that better future, not just for our generation now, but, you know, for our little ones that are going to grow up in this world.
Wow. Wow.
I want to ask you something, and this could sound slightly sexist, but, you know, I could see that a lot of people will look at men who are left brain and whatever, and you expect men to be clueless emotionally. No, really. And I'm wondering what it would be like, maybe for either of you can answer this, is when you run into situations, or if you've dated someone and they project on you kind of emotionality and an emotional softness and emotional whatever, you know, because you're a woman. And then it turns out that it's not like you're masculine, you're neurodiverse. But I'm wondering what that's like when you feel people are projecting on you. Well, of course you'll understand me emotionally. Well, of course you'll connect with me. I wouldn't expect that of a man. And then dealing with those projections when, you know, I'm not negotiating who I am, but, you know, that's not really my strong suit. So have either of you run into that? Because a lot of times, you know, a lot of men are looking for mothers.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll project on you, oh, are you the mommy that I'm looking for and all that? And part of the mommy thing is, oh, you know, the unconditionally, emotionally loving mommy. And again, I don't think men necessarily run into that problem, because we don't project on them to be mommies. We don't even project on them to be daddies. We just project on them to be clueless.
Well, I tell you, I think that that's where the notion of the strong woman comes from. I can't tell you how many times I've been told in my life, you're a strong woman. But I think it's because I just won't take all that offloading, all that projection of emotional stuff from anybody particularly. I think that's part of it, right? And then I get to the point where I go, well, I'm not a strong woman. I have feelings like everybody else. I have the same emotions as anybody else. But then, because I don't take on board that projection, I give the impression of being, in some people's minds, mostly men, because it mostly comes from men, that I'm a strong woman, whatever that means to them. Does that make sense to you?
That's really interesting. You know, and as you were both talking there, I was sort of thinking about the experiences that I've had. And I've often found that the things that when I've been in relationships with men that they have liked about me initially have been the things they have disliked about me in the end. So, and I think I have to take some responsibility with that in terms of I was undiagnosed. In some respects, I was a version of a girlfriend that I thought you were supposed to be. So I would listen. I was kind. I was empathetic. I would do things that showed that I cared in neurodiverse ways. So if we were going somewhere doing something, I would hyper-focus research something. Like, research is my language of love. Like, if I'm, you know, want to do something for somebody, I research it so they get the best experience. And, but there was a point at which, because I was perceived as a strong woman, that when my needs weren't being met, when the men that I was with didn't really care how I felt, didn't really care what was going on in my life, I was just expected to show up whilst they offloaded on me. And when I started to push back, and actually what I did a couple of times was reflect their behavior back at them. It's very common with ADHD to reflect somebody's personality back as it's just, you know, it can be a natural thing. But that's what I would start to do in relationships. As my needs weren't being met, I would reflect that behavior back at a partner, and it would inevitably result in friction, and I would leave, because it would get to a point that I would be saying, but you're not meeting my needs. I'm reflecting your behavior back at you. You don't even see it. You can't even recognize what I am doing is reflecting your behavior back. And I would just check out. And we're talking long-term relationships. But I also think that there is something that's really important to mention on relationships here. And that is that for many I'm going to say neurodiverse women, it may well be the same for men, I can only speak as a neurodiverse woman, become very vulnerable to people that are controlling and have narcissistic tendencies. I have personally experienced that, where somebody can draw me in and be a version of myself that I believe to be true. I'm very literal. If you show me some behaviors and tell me something, I will believe you until other evidence presents to the contrary. And that again is when that behavior can become quite difficult, is that somebody is offloading and offloading, and then when you try to communicate, or I was trying to communicate my needs and my feelings back, and I was met with gaslighting and rejection and, well, no, but you've totally misinterpreted what I've said. So I think that the dynamic, now that I can reflect back with the knowledge of being autistic and ADHD, I can see where that dynamic in a relationship has been very challenging. And I'll be completely honest with you, I have not entered into a relationship since I've been diagnosed. I haven't. I'm not confident in my ability to process that type of relationship. It's just not where I'm at right now.
Wow. Wow. And as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about my relationships and thinking how very similar certain aspects have been in my relationships. Yeah.
But it's confusing, right? When you expect almost somebody to reflect back what you're putting in initially,
yeah.
It's a very hurtful dynamic when you think I'm giving and giving and somebody is taking and taking, and it's confusing. And I think, I don't know about for you, JJ, but for me, I certainly felt like I wasn't lovable. I wasn't worth receiving the same care and kindness back. And it reinforced the shame and the feelings of not being good enough. And because I knew I was different, I always felt like I didn't get the manual to life that others around me got. So it was very toxic, and it was reinforcing my own shame beliefs. And it's painful.
Yeah. Yes. I don't think I felt the shame to the same extent. I don't think that manifested. But certainly there's a pain there. Yeah. When you're not getting back what you need. in a relationship, whether it's with a significant other or family.
Or friends. Yeah.
But I've had to learn, without any diagnosis, I've had to learn how to set those boundaries and understand, you know, the gaslighting, the ghosting, anything like that. Just cut it. I've had to cut that out of my life.
Yeah.
Because it's too painful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know that we talk about, you know, feeling into that pain, but there's it's a bit of a challenge if you're faced with that daily and having
Absolutely.
To feel into that daily and get through it daily. You do get to the point where you say, I don't want this anymore.
Mm.
What do you think, Mark?
Well, are we coming to a break? Because I'm thinking a lot of things.
We are coming to a break. Okay, so after the break, Dr. Mark Gulston will talk more about what we've just been talking about. But for now, we'll just hear these messages from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're still listening to Hurt Less, Live More with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist. Our guest today, Nikki Butler, and Dr. Mark Gulston, who will be now responding to some of the things that Nikki and I were talking about before the break.
Yeah, I was thinking about the word shame and the shame that I feel. It's that superficially, if someone's gaslighting me or manipulating me, You know, superficially, my shame is, oh, I'm disappointing them. Oh, I'm not being a proper friend or whatever. But when I drill down, my shame is the rage I feel underneath it all. So the shame is, you know, down deep, I'm really resentful. And I don't act on it. People would say, you know, you're one of the least rageful people I know. You're very safe. And I think it's a combination of suppression and repression. But I think when I drill down, you know, I'm very aware of my Jungian shadow, you know, and as a therapist for many years, what I realize is everybody has a shadow to their personality. And as long as you can realize, and I was able to realize this as a therapist because I saw that everyone had one, as long as you don't act on it, you're good to go. But a lot of people aren't aware of that. And if down deep you can think, oh, I'm so jealous of my best friend. Oh, I'm a terrible friend. Oh, I hold grudges, even though on the surface I'm smiling. Oh, I'm a terrible grudge holder. And so for me, I think the shame is not being able to realize the universality of these dark parts of our personality and being acting on them. You can feel guilty because, oh, I acted out on that. Whereas even not acting on them, you can feel shame inside. I'm a bad person. So I just wanted to share that. That you know, at the surface level, it was feeling made to be feel ashamed at not giving in to someone who was gaslighting me or manipulating me, and so I wanted to throw that into the mix. If either of you could identify with that,
I identify with that definitely. Yeah, what do you think, Nikki?
Yeah, as you were saying that, it was something that came up for me in therapy. Yeah, it probably 10, 12 years ago, so pre-diagnosis, is I suppress anger. And there were some things that had happened and my therapist had said to me, how do you feel? And I said, I feel nothing. And she was, and this went on for a few weeks. And she said, I feel angry on your behalf. Do you feel angry? I said, no, I feel nothing. And what I had somehow done with my anger is learn to numb it. So even now, it's not an emotion I naturally connect with, and it is most likely a shame response. But now I know that when in the pit of my stomach, or I have that nothing feeling, so something has happened, but there's numbness, I now know for me that that is most likely anger. And that was so interesting listening to you say that. And the reason I've numbed the emotion out, I suspect, is because I have shame attached to anger, to an anger response. Really interesting.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Maybe JJ, we've talked about our childhoods, and I can see how as a child, and not understanding these things, when you can feel anger and rage at a parent that you're still totally dependent on, you know, there can be the feeling, that's wrong. You know, I can't feel such destructive feelings as long as I'm dependent on them. And so I will, you know, deflect it, internalize it. And it's interesting because, you know, one of the things that I have this tactic from one of my books. It's called the FUD crud technique. And so when someone is venting or they're frustrated with you, what you say to them is you let them vent. And in my mind, I go FUD crud, and they'll vent, and they're expecting to manipulate me. And what I do instead is I'll say, you know, you seem really frustrated with me, and I think you're holding back. I think you're upset and disappointed too. What? Yeah, you seem frustrated, but I'll bet you're upset and disappointed. Why don't you fill me in on all of those? And so when you can pull it out of them, each of them, when you get to disappointment, it's much calmer. But you want to pull out, and I use the word upset instead of angry, because you don't want to say to someone, well, you seem frustrated, but I'll bet you're also angry at me. I am not angry. You know, so they can accept being upset. And so you pull out of them. So what might you be frustrated about? And you don't take issue with it. You say, I can see how you might feel that way. And you're upset about what? And again, you're just pulling it out of them completely. And you can watch them calm down and say, and I'm sure you're disappointed with me, with us. We're back here in the same situation. What's that about? And if you practice this, you can watch it calm them down, and you don't get infected by what they're saying, because you feel kind of in charge of the conversation without being controlling.
That's so powerful. That's really, I'm going to try that. That's so interesting. Because I never lost my temper in my life. I never. And when somebody starts to, I've had people lose their temper with me and I become mute. I just don't respond. It makes my blood run cold and I just feel like I have to get to safety. I have to get out of there. And I would avoid conflict at all costs. But the word that really triggered me was disappointed. And that's so interesting, because I would rather somebody was angry with me than disappointed in me.
So, oh, yeah, Abby, absolutely. Yeah. Telling your child I'm disappointed in you, it's
the worst, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, you're what? You're disappointed in me. But I can take anger when it's directed at me, because I can almost be non-responsive to anger. But that's so interesting. I'm going to try that technique.
Yeah. Well, because I think when people are angry in our mind, you know, we can discount it. We can, you know, the person's being such an idiot, blah, 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 blah. And whereas when someone says disappointed, you know, it's much more powerful. But again, if the tactic is when you draw it out of them, and you're not necessarily agreeing with their what they're disappointed about, what you're doing is you're de-escalating the conversation. You could do this with customer service. Yeah. Customer service, like, wow, you really seem frustrated. Let them vent. And I think you're upset and disappointed. So fill me in on all of those and let's see what can happen. And I will tell you, if you can draw all the frustration and the upset out of them and then the disappointment, and you just listen to them, a fair amount of people will apologize.
Yeah, it's very powerful.
They're just so grateful that you didn't tune them out, you didn't pull away. So it's a way of taking charge of conversations without being controlling. And I have a book out that you might like. It's called Talking to Crazy: How to Deal with How to Deal with the Irrational and Impossible People in Your Life. And it's about really dealing, it's not about mental health. It's really dealing with all those people that drive us crazy.
And I think that's really relevant to something I was saying at the beginning about this approaching everybody's experiences with loving curiosity. Because if somebody is frustrated or upset or angry, that is their lived experience. And they're going to be looking at the situation through a different lens to us. And, you know, there's this beautiful analogy that I remind people of all the time. And many years ago, a coach said it to me. He said, you can go to Paris and you can go with a group of friends and it's sunny, you've got ice cream, you've got the Eiffel Tower, you come back, Paris is great. You go to Paris with your partner, it's raining, you've had an argument, the Eiffel Tower's closed, you come back, Paris is rubbish. But Paris is Paris. It's the lens that you're looking at it through that determines your experience and your perception of whether Paris is lovely or not. And I apply that logic a lot whenever there's kind of conflict or people are talking about the same situation or memories. When I, you know, even think about childhood memories and when my parents will tell a story and I have an entirely different version. I think we all have our own experiences that are true for us, even if somebody can't immediately understand them. And that really ties in, I think, with what I was saying about being autistic and ADHD and removing stereotypes, is that curiosity and that belief that even if you can't understand it, even if you can't place what somebody is telling you, that is their truth and that is their experience in that moment. And so what you've just said is really powerful tool that is part of that.
Yeah, here's another tool if you like that.
Love it.
it's called reverse psychology, and it's when you ask the other person to say words to you that are really even much more intense than what they're saying. So if you're with someone and the dynamic is going on, and you can say to them, "Can we try something that I think might help the situation that we get stuck in? Can you say this to me, Mark? I hate it when you get so logical like this. You're such an arrogant, nitwit, and you think you're so smart and all that sort of stuff, and you're not so smart. You're really an idiot. So, honey, could you say that to me and lean into it if you feel it?" Yeah. And so when you're giving them the words, like I often suggest this to parents, but especially mothers when they're trying to get their high schooler to do the homework and it's not working. So you knock on the door and you say, "Honey, can I talk to you about the homework situation? Can I just come in? It might help." "What?" And you go in there and you say, "Can you say this to me?" And, just pretend you feel it. "Mom, can you get off my effing back with the homework already? Every time you do it, it's the last thing I want to do. You are so effing clueless. you know, you're just so out of it. You know, can you just leave the room and then I'm going to go do video games because you got me so upset. So, honey, could you say that to me? And what happens is the teenager starts giggling.
That would be my response to start
just
laughing.
Just as we did. We started
so
laughing.
Because you've given them a safe outlet.
Yeah.
For all this anger they feel that chills them. You know, a lot of teenagers hate hating their parents. They don't know where it comes from. So you give them an outlet.
Mm.
You know, and then when they lean into it, you say to them, honey, you can do a little bit better. Come on, lean into it. And then what's happening is they're just getting it all off their chest and they start giggling because they're relieved of it.
Yeah.
Whereas if normally they had said that to you, you'd say, you need to take a time out. That's not being respectful. But what you're doing instead is you're inviting them to get it off their chest.
And I guess by giving them the words, you're also letting them know that it's okay to have those thoughts and that they would have had those thoughts towards their parents when they were younger. And it, because I definitely had feelings of not just guilt, but shame. And guilt and confusion all layered in together, because there's my parents that love me unconditionally. And you don't understand when you're younger that they're doing things. You have structure because you need structure and, you know, you can't run feral. So you do have these frustrations. But I think as you're growing up, you don't understand your emotions. So there's so much that we then take through into adulthood, isn't there? That, you know, when somebody that you're in a relationship or a friendship and you're frustrated or annoyed with somebody, and then you think, but that's the person that I love or loves me and I shouldn't feel this way. And we start to have these destructive narratives without understanding that the whole range of emotions and thoughts and feelings, it's like a roller coaster, isn't it? How many, I did read research some about how many thoughts and emotions and feelings we have in a day. Nothing lasts forever. And I always think about the less positive thoughts, feelings and emotions. I think of them as clouds. And I just think, I'm just going to watch them go by in the sky. I'm not going to start trying to interfere with them and, you know, kind of jump in and, you know, move them out of the way. If you just let them float on by, then another thought, emotional feeling is going to replace it. And that dissipates the power sometimes for me as well.
I think that's a brilliant strategy. And I have loved this conversation, but unfortunately, we are coming to the end. I'm really sorry about that.
It's been bad talking to you.
I think the three of us could talk forever. But Nikki, do tell us before we sign off, where can people get in touch with you? So you work only with women who have a diagnosis of autism and ADHD?
No, don't have to have a diagnosis. Diagnosis is very hard to come by, particularly at the moment with waiting lists. So anybody that is autistic or ADHD, female entrepreneurs that really want to, I guess, lean into their strengths and make the most of their lives and redefine success on their terms. I have online coaching programs. And it's really about working with the women that are going to be bold and brave and step up so we can all be a catalyst for change to get rid of these stereotypes. So my website is all very easy. The website is autisticjoyologist.co.uk and my social media handles are @autisticjoyologist.
All very simple. Yeah. Mark, it's been a pleasure, hasn't it, to have Nikki on the show?
Oh, this has been terrific. This has been very special. Thank you, Nikki.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. And thank you to everybody for listening. Do join us another time for more Hurt Less, Live More here on UK Health Radio. But for now, goodbye from all of us here.